From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Coming up this week, we'll mark the anniversary of a moratorium on whether to allow hydrofracking in New York State. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, shares his thoughts on the New York City mayoral campaign, and the governor signs two bills into law dealing with police dogs. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. This week, New York entered into its sixth year of a de facto moratorium on whether to allow hydrofracking for natural gas in the state. Business and industry groups are expressing dismay over what they say is too long of a delay. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
In the summer of 2008, then-Governor David Paterson and the legislature imposed an actual moratorium in New York on the gas drilling process known as hydrofracking. After it expired, Governor Cuomo's environmental agency began an extended review. That study has never been completed. For the past 10 months, a decision has been put on hold while Governor Cuomo's health commissioner conducts what he says is a health review. No details have been revealed. Brian Sampson, with the pro-business group Unshackle Upstate, calls it paralysis by analysis.
It's very disingenuous to the people to say that, you know, here we are 5 years later and we haven't been able to make a decision.
Sampson praises Governor Cuomo for advancing the state's yogurt, beer, and wine industries, but he says that won't create enough new employment to make up for the loss of the manufacturing and other more lucrative jobs.
Nothing is going to create better jobs, more high-paying jobs, more sustainable jobs than the development of the Marcellus Shale along the Southern Tier. Until that point, any administration can talk about what they're doing to help that region, and it's really just false promises.
The Joint Landowners Coalition, a group based in the Southern Tier who wants to lease their land to gas drillers, says the review period in other states has been significantly shorter. In Ohio, it took just 8 months, in Illinois, 17 months, and in California, 2 years. All three states are likely to approve fracking soon. Karen Moreau with the Petroleum Council says when Governor Cuomo took office, she expected he would make a decision early on in his term. She says the only possible conclusion 3 years later is that the governor is delaying for political reasons. She says he's afraid of offending fracking opponents.
What you do hear certainly is a lot of noise from the opposition. They continue to rattle their sabers and to threaten the governor that if he lifts the moratorium, you know, he will have to pay politically. So I think it's just become more of a political stalemate than anything else.
Sampson and Moreau say while there's been no hydrofracking in New York, other things have been happening during these past 5 years. Moreau says more people are leaving the state.
It's just unfortunate that the untold story are those people quietly leaving New York.
Environmental groups are pleased that there's been no decision to go ahead with fracking, but they remain concerned because they say despite the five-year delay, their questions and concerns have still not been answered. Travis Prue with Environmental Advocates says the Cuomo administration review process has been shrouded in secrecy.
While we're happy that a decision hasn't yet been made, I think everybody's justifiably concerned with the fact that nobody knows knows what's going on. This has been a very secretive process from beginning to end. We don't know who is looking at what. We don't know what considerations they are looking at. We don't know ultimately how the final decision is going to be made.
Prue says there's also been no answer on the hundreds of thousands of comments the public has submitted to the state's Department of Environmental Conservation.
We don't know if their comments are even being read or reviewed or considered in any type of way.
Environmental Advocates is seeking another two-year moratorium on fracking while a more definitive assessment is conducted. The Assembly has approved a measure, but it stalled in the state Senate. Prue says despite the now five-year delay, New Yorkers still don't know about potential public health effects.
A decision that's made uninformed could have disastrous consequences.
A spokesman for Governor Cuomo says there's nothing new on when a decision on fracking could come. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You know, politics is bizarre sometimes,
you
and
bet.
We're witnessing what's happening in New York City with the mayoral campaign, most notably Anthony Weiner. What are you making of all this, Alan?
Well, the first thing I'm making of it, as I read the polls, they're coming out daily. Weiner is still leading in the polls. Now, there is something going on here that I think a lot of people aren't catching, which is that virtually every newspaper is full bore out, absolutely, to get this guy out of here. They're editorializing against him. They're doing stories like, what do women think of Anthony Weiner? And we're talking about across the board from, you know, from the always rabid New York Post to the New York Times. They have decided that it's their job to make sure this guy doesn't get there. Well, I understand their feelings. You know, I never liked them, to be honest with you. But I do think that the people have a right to decide. So why is he leading in the polls? Well, I think it's like page six of the tabloids. People, they're having fun. They're watching this thing and saying, hey, I've screwed up in my life. This guy's a real screw-up. His character isn't that good, obviously. You know, he gets outed, and then he does the same thing again. He starts to text or sext or whatever you want to call it again. This goes to Freud's idea that character is set at four and never changes. And I suspect that people are really, really angry about the way in which papers have decided, the news media have decided to do him in. I don't know. As I say, I wouldn't vote for him, but on the other hand, and when people call me up on the radio and they say, I just heard this guy do a commentary and I didn't like it, and he should never be on this station. And I say, lady, if you heard it, or mister, if you heard it, somebody else heard it, they came to the same conclusion or not. Well, that's what elections are all about, folks.
We just heard a story from our Karen DeWitt.
Yeah.
About going into a sixth year now in New York State on a fracking moratorium.
Mm-hmm.
And business leaders reacting, environmentalists reacting, but still no movement on this issue. What's going on, Alan?
Well, I think, frankly, that the governor has been paralyzed on this. What happened is that the governor came in, he was fiscally conservative, and he was a liberal on the social issues. And it worked. First 2 years, he was applauded by the, you know, center-right and the far-right, who said, oh, he's doing the right things, he's anti-tax, he's doing what needs to be done to bring business to New York. One of the things that clearly looked appealing to him was fracking. You know, if you set up fracking, you bring business to the Marcellus Shale and to the Pennsylvania border and anything for upstate, because he knew his weaknesses were upstate. And I think he was going to do it. But then something happened. Lightning struck. And there was a sense that somehow this became a liberal cause. And the liberal community, the center-left in this state, reacting to the kinds of, I think, very good science that said, hey, whoa, 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 be careful before you do this. We're talking about the potential for dirtying our most precious resource, our waters, and messing up with all kinds of things that we don't know, but have earthquakes that have been sighted out in the West and have been happening. And really, do you really want to fool around with this until you know? So the governor goes to his people and he says, you do this. You know, you do an explanation of this. And they have hearings and comments come in by the thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands. And the governor takes a look at this and says, whoa, this has got to be looked at very carefully. So he goes to the Department of Environmental Conservation. They do a study. Then they go to the Health Department, and they do a study. And it's the Health Department study, which has not come back yet. Nobody wants to be caught, well, in the Anthony Weiner way, with their pants down on this thing. And so that is why we haven't heard anything yet. This paralysis, because there is no good way to go for the governor.
One of the folks you talk with this week is Republican Assemblyman Jim Todisco, an interesting guy and someone who was once the minority leader but sort of stepped down from that.
Well, I don't know whether he was stepped or pushed, but I can tell you this. He's the most one of the most interesting guys in state politics. I love him. I don't agree with him, but I love the way that he can take an issue and then present it as if we had never looked at it before. And he is fearless. He's very proud of the fact that when Eliot Spitzer was governor and they were having a fight, Eliot said to him what JT said in the song Steamroller, "I'm an effing steamroller and I'm going to steam right over you." Well, he ran to the press with that one and it got him a lot of press. And this guy's all about press because, after all, he's in the minority party. He's in the Republican Party, which is an endangered species in New York State, and especially in the New York State Assembly, because the Assembly keeps, you know, changing the districts so that only the Democrats can win and the Republicans are going to lose. And as I say, an endangered species like salamanders, maybe a rare kind of salamander, that's what they are. So there he is, fighting the good fight, fighting the rear guard action. He was a hell of a basketball player in college, and afterwards he's still playing, even though he's a little bit older now. And he's just one of those guys who's refreshing to watch.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo signed into law two bills pertaining to police dogs this week. The Hudson Valley Assemblyman sponsored both, and we get that story from the Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn.
One bill elevates to a Class E felony the killing of a police dog or police horse. Republican George Maziarz sponsored the bill in the Senate.
Actually, in Niagara County, in the area that I represent, 2 years ago now, there was a police dog killed in the line of duty. His name was Rocky, and I actually went to his funeral.
Maziarz and Democrat Kenneth Zebrowski, who sponsored the bill in the Assembly, point to a second police dog killing that occurred after the bill was introduced. Here's Zebrowski.
Making the killing of a police dog a felony, we had sponsored earlier this year, but it really came to light in the unfortunate circumstances in Herkimer County where the dog Ape was shot and killed. I think it was an example of how valiant these animals, these dogs, can be. And that dog Ape not only saved law enforcement lives, but saved civilian lives as well.
He refers to the 2-year-old FBI dog Ape, killed upstate in Herkimer County by a gunman who was hiding out in an abandoned bar. That gunman had fatally shot 4 people before he was killed. Maziarz says Ape's death, 2 years after Rocky's, drew more support for his legislation.
Unfortunately, because of the second incident, you know, and the additional media attention, Governor Cuomo called me up and was very interested in the bill, and we moved it through the legislature and able to get it signed into law.
The law currently classifies the killing of a police animal as a Class A misdemeanor. The new law elevating the penalty to a Class E felony takes effect November 1st. Zebrowski from New City in Rockland County sponsored another bill. It pertains to police dogs that bite someone during the course of official work.
We've updated our laws so that these animals no longer will have a 10-day waiting period if they bite a criminal in the apprehension. And it's important to note that our local police departments oftentimes only have 1 or 2 dogs. So by having a dog in a mandatory quarantine period, they're down and aren't able to carry out their investigations. What this bill does is it allows the local health department to sign off on a waiver, check their vaccinations, and get these dogs back out into the field.
Independent Democrat David Carlucci sponsored the bill in the Senate. Zebrowski says the Clarkstown police in his district were the impetus for the bill.
There was a murder a couple years ago where they used their police dog to track down and apprehend the individual in North New City. What they found is it's a drain on their resources, and they weren't able to go back into the field with these animals because of the mandatory quarantine period. So the Clarkstown police had approached myself and Senator Carlucci and asked us to update the law, And we worked on it and got it done this year.
The law takes effect immediately.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
The budget debate in Washington has Great Lakes advocates calling foul and lobbying for a turnabout in a proposed funding cut to the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. We get that story from the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley.
The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, or GLRI, is a collaboration of the 8 states bordering the lakes, including New York and Pennsylvania, that works to restore and protect the basin's ecosystem. A coalition briefing on restoration efforts and the EPA revised plan was changed as the initiative's federal funding was swept up in Monday's budget debate in Washington. Coalition campaign director Todd Ames says the House Interior, Environment, and Related Agency Subcommittee released proposed drastic cuts to the Great Lakes program.
We wanted to talk about our comments on the new draft action plan from the U.S. EPA for the next 5 years of this critically important GLRI work. But that was before we saw that this bill slashes the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative by nearly 80% from the current level of $285 million to a proposed $60 million for fiscal year 2014. We were going to discuss how the need is even more urgent as the impacts of climate change are taking an increasing toll on these lakes that provide nearly 20% of all of the freshwater resources on the planet. But that was before this bill was proposed to eviscerate funding for Great Lakes restoration programs that are producing results for the environment and the economy.
GLRI works with a broad diversity of partners, including federal, state, and local agencies, conservation and environmental groups, tribes, business, academic, and non-governmental organizations on projects such as wetlands restoration, invasive species prevention, beach access improvement, sewage and toxic sediment cleanup. There have been about 1,650 projects funded, totaling nearly $950 million in the 8 Great Lakes states. Alliance for the Great Lakes CEO and President Joel Brammeier says the House cuts disproportionately single out those programs.
These cuts don't appear to be in keeping with a fair across-the-board strategy that has been talked about in the past. And in this case, we're talking about money that is going to communities, to states, to pay for on-the-ground projects that benefit millions of people across the Great Lakes region.
The coalition's Todd Ames says a cut was expected, but not of this magnitude.
We were certainly surprised by the amount of the cut, both to this and to things like the Clean Water State Revolving Fund. And cutting this funding now just makes the price tag for fixing the problems in the future more expensive.
Healing Our Waters Great Lakes Coalition Policy Director Chad Lord hopes the cuts are merely part of a federal budget debate and will not be approved.
Yesterday, the subcommittee handed us a lemon, the result of a House budget which was passed earlier this year, which set unrealistic budget expectations. 38 members of Congress wrote to this subcommittee, Democrats and Republicans, asking that GLRI funding be maintained. Bipartisan legislation was just introduced yesterday supporting original funding levels for the GLRI.
The full House Appropriations Committee will review the bill next week. Full House consideration is not expected until after the August recess. The Senate has yet to act on similar legislation.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. 18 Mile Creek in Lockport has been a designated area of concern for decades. Because of recent flooding, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is now weighing the option of permanently relocating people living closest to the creek ahead of a massive site cleanup. As the Innovation Trail's Ashley Hassett reports, a solution can't come soon enough for affected residents.
Located in Niagara County, 18 Mile Creek flows north for about 15 miles and into Lake Ontario. The watershed's been tested for contaminants by the State Department of Environmental Conservation since the late 1980s. The EPA took over testing of the site in 2011. Public Affairs Officer with the agency, Michael Basile, says the creek's been placed on the national priority list, which means more time and resources can be allocated for the site.
At our meeting on June the 5th, we explained to the residents that were there, about 75, that we would be coming back to them with our proposed plan for the first part of the cleanup, probably this summer.
Resident Shirley Nichols says she's been hearing about cleanup plans for the creek for years. On a hot and humid summer day, Nichols takes me to a footpath near the creek to see what residents have been dealing with. She points out the obvious rotten egg smell coming from the watershed.
It didn't smell. Ooh, it's greenish.
Part of the problem is that the remains of the former Flint Coat plant still hang over the creek. The dilapidated building originally dates from the 19th century, and before it closed its doors in 1971, was used to manufacture paper and asphalt products. 26-year-old resident Kate Fitzsimmons grew up living across the street from the site. She says water and soil testing revealed a long list of toxins that include PCBs, asbestos, lead, mercury, and pesticides.
I knew that there was stuff in it just because of how many fires we had when I was little. I remember, like, almost every single summer we had some kind of fire that happened next door. I just knew that there had to be something in there that was causing it to be so flammable, especially since it's all brick.
Fitzsimmons says her family feels like they're stuck in Lower Lockport. No one in the area can sell their house because of the contaminated creek.
When I was younger, I always said I wanted to live here because this is the house I grew up in. But if I wanted to move my parents out and I wanted to move myself, I would have to make sure that the house is condemned in order to make sure that I don't have to pay for it anymore.
Fitzsimmons says she suffers from asthma and now wonders whether the creek might have something to do with it. Professor at SUNY Environmental Science and Forestry, John Hassett, no relation, says human health is the number one reason to clean up contaminated watersheds as soon as possible.
A source like 18 Mile Creek is a contaminant source to Lake Ontario, and so it would wind up contaminating the lake-wide environment. Something like PCBs, when they're going into a lake like Lake Ontario, some of it goes to the sediments and remains there, and some of it accumulates in the fish that are in the lake. And continuing sources like 18 Mile Creek are why we have continuing fish advisories for don't eat the fish or eat limited amounts of fish from the lakes.
Recent flooding added a sense of urgency to the debate over cleanup as area residents had to deal with the toxic water seeping into their basements. Basile says the Flint Coat building will be investigated, but the company was only one of many that were based along the waterway over the years.
Many of the former industrial facilities that we're looking at are no longer in business. Some are in business, and we're also looking at municipalities in the county as well. They do an awful lot, and they have provided us with a lot of great information, but at the same time, we have to try to identify polluters, knowing that if we can identify who polluted the creek, they can help us defray the cost of cleanup.
Now lawmakers have chimed in, urging the EPA to permanently relocate the residents. Senator Charles Schumer says that would be the cheapest option. It's around $250,000 to buy out all six families. Basile says that is a possibility, but they did consider another plan.
We are contemplating putting down a protective barrier on those properties, which could cost the government about $1.2 million.
Resident Shirley Nichols doesn't think capping the creek is going to fix the problem.
All they're going to do is take out a little bit and put some soil on it, and that's only going to last about 3 years. Now, they've taken out some of the pollution, got rid of that, but now they've got more pollution they got to get rid of, so that doubles the hazard. They don't want all that much to get the heck out of there. Buy them out, get them out, and every family but one have children down there.
The EPA's Michael Basile says they're still taking public comment before they decide on a course of action. He estimates that it's going to take at least 5 to 10 years to complete just the first three phases of cleanup.
When you look at the fact that industry, municipalities, and even the public could have contaminated this water over the years and into last century, it's not going to be cleaned up overnight.
City of Lockport Mayor Mike Tucker was contacted for comment on 18 Mile Creek, but was in Albany lobbying for flood relief funds and unavailable. In Buffalo, I'm Ashley Hassett for the Innovation Trail.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That number, 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1330. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.